Hi, and welcome to the After Animals podcast.
After Animals uncovers trends and stories at the cutting edge of the global post-animal movement. What does a future look like in which food, fashion, and entertainment no longer have to exploit animals to be successful?
Each episode, we will share with you a remarkable and inspiring story about someone who is forging a more compassionate future for us all.
After Animals is co-produced and hosted by me, Yulara Nakagawa,
and me, Sharanya Krishnaprasad.
Yulara, in this episode, I talk with Shannon Falconer, who has a PhD in microbial chemical biology, and she left a very lucrative career at Stanford University to start her company, Because Animals. What is really cool about this is that she has managed to find a way to merge both her passion as well as her career. And she loves cats and dogs. She used to volunteer at shelters. And over a period of time, she started realizing that the pet food industry was just so cruel and so inhumane. And so she started thinking of ways to come up with a novel approach to produce pet food that doesn't harm animals. And her company is actually producing pet food from cultured mice cells.
It's mind-blowing. We laugh because it's so novel and so striking and so just out there in a way. Yeah, so when you were telling me about this interview, I got really excited. And I think I had mentioned it to a couple of my fellow cat-owning friends, let's call them. And our main thing was, okay, that's cool, because we tend to have an association to cats chasing mice. But in this day and age, the average modern house cat is not subsisting off of a diet of actual mice, unless you're like a barn cat out in the country. So we want to know, why mice? Is it even like a wholesome diet for domesticated cats? And, you know, prove it to us before we start feeding it to our cats. I mean, you know, it's all very curious. It's all very cool. It's just, that's the kind of the thing that comes to the forefront of your mind as a modern cat owner.
Yes. And you hit on something that we discussed during the interview. And so Stay tuned and you will hear all that Shannon had to say about it.
Can't wait.
Shannon, thank you so much for being with us today. I would love to get started with, what made you do this? It was a leap of faith, but clearly a great one. So tell us more about it.
Sure, of course. Thank you very much for having me on the show. And I will just begin by apologizing in advance for any barking if we are interrupted. My dogs are with me. And yes, they may start barking spontaneously at any time. So I just wanted to put that disclaimer out there. Yes, I started this company 3 years ago. And as you mentioned, I left my postdoc to do this. Of course, I'm a scientist by training, and so I've spent many, many, many years in the lab, and this has been my interest, sort of my primary interest, but for actually probably close to 2 decades now, I've been very actively involved in the animal rescue community. While I was working on my PhD, you know, I would be sort of at the bench during the day, and then in the evenings, I'd be doing adoption coordination or answering TNR-related questions or going to attend colonies of feral cats. And I did this for many years. And so I guess I didn't ever really see an opportunity where I might marry my scientific love with my, you know, my sort of obsession around animal rescue. But it was while I was working at Stanford, and I'm in this incredible environment, and, you know, the attitude, obviously, for anybody who's ever lived in the Bay Area, I mean, it's just this phenomenal place where anything and everything is possible. And so I'd say that was really what inspired me and gave me the courage to say, I'm going to cease my academic pursuits and apply all of this science that I've been trained with to try and improve the lives of animals and to take animals out of the supply chain, importantly. So this was several years ago, and initially I was thinking about human food, and of course factory farmed animals, although personally I've been involved in animal rescue with just dogs and cats, but factory farmed animals are probably of the most overlooked. And so, I was thinking about, perhaps applying my science to work on alternatives for human food. But, you know, there are many other players in the space and not enough, but still others. But the one product that doesn't or didn't exist was basically food for me to buy for my pets. I mean, I already have options when I go to the grocery store for non-animal based foods for myself, but I really didn't have any options for my pets and fosters and rescues that would come in and out my door. So yeah, that's when I decided that pet food, that would be the focus. And from there, I met my co-founder, Joshua Arrett, and he has an MBA and a background in finance and entrepreneurship, which was great because, you know, my background is science. And he also happened to be actively involved in the animal rescue community for quite some time. And he was looking for ways to basically apply his skills to improve the lives of animals. So we came together and we started the company Because Animals.
That's amazing. Tell me more about what the company does right now, because I know when I look online, I see that you sell some superfoods and some supplements for dogs and cats. Mm-hmm. But tell me what else you're working on that's coming up in the future.
So we are making, of course, food for pets that is completely animal-free. And so our first product to launch, we launched about a year and a half ago now, as you mentioned, superfood and probiotic supplement. It's a product that people add to their pet's diet already. And this, it's a blend of ingredients that contain nutrients that are commonly missing from a lot of pet foods. And so these are not nutrients that animals necessarily need to survive, but it definitely helps them thrive. So trace minerals from marine macroalgae, a probiotic that's been shown to improve immunity and digestion. So we started with that product. Our next product, which we'll be launching, is a cookie for dogs. It's a plant and yeast-based cookie. And I will say, though, that the really exciting products that we're working on are our cultured meat products. We are growing meat without the animal. We're in the process of building out our scientific team. So myself, two stem cell engineers, and a tissue scientist, we are creating, our first product will be actually a cultured mouse tissue. This would be cultured mouse for a cat treat. And the reason why we chose mouse tissue is because very, very basically, mice are the ancestral diets of cats. So at the moment, people, they feed their pets food that contains animal protein that basically comes from leftovers of the human food system. And so bovine and poultry protein are the most common. They also happen to be the main allergens for cats and dogs. The first thing a vet will do, typically if a pet parent is presenting their pet with an allergy, which either manifests topically or gastrointestinally, is look at whether or not, if they change the protein source, whether or not this will improve. So, and in many instances, actually, that protein source can be soy. But there are various reasons, people don't necessarily love soy. So for us, it made a lot of sense to say, okay, well, why don't we start with growing the actual ancestral food of cats? And so that's mouse tissue. So that's what we're working on at the moment. In the spring of this year, we did create a prototype where we grew mouse tissue. And for folks who know about cultured meat, we grew it without using fetal bovine serum. So FBS is a really common ingredient that that folks use to culture tissue, not just in the cultured meat startups, but in the biomedical community where people have been growing tissue since the 50s. So FBS is a really common ingredient. We were able to grow it we created a media that does not contain any animal ingredients, doesn't contain any FBS. So we grew this mouse tissue, and then we combined it with a number of other ingredients that cats find tasty, and we baked it. And then we had a small cohort of cats sample our cultured mouse cat treats, and we had, it was a success. So that was great. So we're moving forward with the cultured mouse years. And we're looking to launch a first product in early 2021 with the cultured mouse cat treat. And eventually we will move into a nutritionally complete food for cats as well. We are also working on a cultured meat food for dogs. But for us, the emphasis really is on cats at the moment because there are plant-based options for dogs, but nothing exists for cats. So for us, in our mind, they're the priority species at this point for us. Yeah.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And I have heard from many cat parents who are vegetarian or vegan that they feel very conflicted about this because they themselves are not consuming animals or animal products, but they feel like they need to feed their pets these products because they feel like that's part of their diet and that's what they've evolved to consume.
Yeah. I mean, so it is known scientifically, dogs are omnivores. So right. Actually, metabolically speaking, they are much more similar to humans when it comes to food than they would be to cats. But certainly cats are unable to manufacture endogenously or in their own body certain key nutrients that we can make, for example, that dogs can make as well. And they have to obtain those nutrients from their diet. And in the wild, the only source of those nutrients is another animal. So specifically, everybody talks about taurine. That is a beta amino acid that we're able to manufacture ourselves. Dogs are able to manufacture ourselves. Cats are not. Formed vitamin A, so retinol is another one that cats need to obtain from the diet. Arachidonic acid. There are a few examples. And so in the wild, cats can obtain these nutrients by eating mice or small birds or insects. But interestingly, I will note that in pet food, actually, commercial pet food, if any pet parent wants to, any cat parent specifically wants to read the ingredient list of their food, they will find taurine listed there separately. They'll find retinol or vitamin A there listed separately, arachidonic acid, and a number of others. And so these nutrients actually in commercial pet food, those are synthetic. Those are made synthetically. So there is a little bit of, a lot of misunderstanding around cats being carnivores in the wild. Yes, absolutely. Right. But for those domesticated cats that are being fed a commercial diet, most of those key nutrients that are essential for cats, they're not coming from the meat that's contained in the pet food. They're coming from those nutrients that have been synthesized and added separately to the food after the fact. So yeah, most people don't realize this. Pet food is the way that it's made. It's very heavily manufactured. And the process, a lot of nutrients are lost. So the nutrient that the meat really provides is the protein or the amino acids. But those other nutrients that are so critical for cats, they are largely sourced synthetically. Something you brought up earlier with respect to pet food coming from sort of being the leftovers made with a lot of the 4D meat, so animals dead, diseased, dying, disabled, or those parts of the animal that humans don't want to eat. And so these components are then sent to a facility called a rendering facility, and they are basically, they're decontaminated. This meat is then used for pet food. So the argument can be made, it has been made, that actually the pet food industry is a sustainable one because this meat that would otherwise go to waste, we are feeding it to our pet. But the one thing that people don't think about is just how much the pet food industry serves to support the viability, the economic feasibility of the factory farming industry. So in the absence of being able to sell all of this meat, so those portions of meat that that humans don't eat, or those animals that never make it to slaughter, right? Because there's a significant number of animals that don't ever make it to slaughter due to suffocation, dehydration, in transit, etc. Those animals, the factory farming industry is still able to basically see some profit from these animals because they can sell it to pet food. So in the absence of having this outlet, which is the pet food industry, there would be huge ramifications in terms of budgets, right? And so things have to change dramatically. also, you know, the welfare of animals would have to change dramatically because it would no longer be viable. You don't have the option of saying, okay, well, these animals that had this sort of poor quality of life and died prior to slaughter, you don't have the option of seeing getting your money back from those animals anymore. So there are a lot of changes that would be forced upon them without having pet food as an outlet. You know, there are two perspectives that you from which you can look at pet food. It's from the sustainability perspective, or it's sustaining the factory farming industry by providing the outlet for all of this other meat that would go uneaten.
Yeah, and it all factors into that cost as well. Like, factory farm meat is so cheap for so many reasons, but among them is this, because they're able to, you know, get money out of what is essentially trash to them.
Right.
But,
right.
You know, it's a multi-billion dollar industry where we're feeding it to our most beloved family members.
Yeah. So there are problems from, you know, feeding one's pet a commercial diet made with meat from industrially farmed animals, right? So one being that there's concern around whether or not this is actually good for our pets. So every year, multiple times a year, the FDA issues recalls on pet food, typically due to bacterial or chemical contamination. Just last year, the FDA recalled food as they found there were traces of pentobarbital, which is a euthanizing agent.
Oh my goodness.
This was found in pet food, and how it got there is still not known exactly. But pentobarbital is never found in human food meat. So there is some concern around, you know, the safety of the food for our pets. There's also, of course, the treatment of the factory farmed animals themselves. Yeah, arguably one might say, well, if we couldn't feed them to pets and there was no money to be made from all of these fallen animals, then perhaps standards would change. The other big issue is sustainability. So one researcher recently published an article that showed that more than a quarter of the environmental effects of the factory farming industry in terms of deforestation, water and fossil fuel use is directly attributed to the foods that Americans feed their cats and dogs. And then, yeah, lastly, I'd say the something that if nobody cares about any of those three reasons, they don't feel that any of those three affect them directly, they might care about this last one, the fourth one, which is that 80% of the pharmaceuticals manufactured in the U.S. are sold to the animal agriculture industry. 70% of those antibiotics are therapeutically relevant, meaning that they're administered to people. Animals are fed these antibiotics at sublethal doses. It doesn't actually necessarily kill bacteria at these doses, but researchers or farmers have found is that it tends to sort of beef up the animals. So it makes them fatter, more profitable. But by delivering these subtherapeutic doses, the problem is that then, because it doesn't kill bacteria, those doses don't kill the bacteria, this provides a really excellent environment whereby bacteria can develop mechanisms of resistance to these drugs. Antibiotic resistance is a crisis, right, for people specifically. There are many, many bugs at this point that we just don't have antibiotics to treat.
Yeah.
Because they've developed so many multiple mechanisms of resistance around different antibiotics. And it just because you might not eat meat, that doesn't matter. The real issue is the manure, right? So the bacteria that then become resistant in the guts or the rumen of these animals, they defecate, the stool contains the bacteria that have these multiple mechanisms of resistance. But once they get into the water and the soil system, then there's no controlling it. So regardless of what you eat, it's in the environment. So yeah, there are many reasons to think about how we can reduce/eliminate the use of animals in agriculture. And that definitely includes how we feed our pets.
Great points made there. Yulara, I feel like what we should talk about is the scope and the scale of what Shannon's doing. I feel we can spend a couple of minutes just talking about the pet food industry in general.
Sure.
The U.S. leads the world in pet food spending. In terms of the global market for pet food, the size was estimated to be $83 billion last year.
Wow.
and it's expected to grow to $113 billion by 2025. So in the next 5-6 years.
Mm-hmm.
And the pet food industry is controlled by 4 companies right now, and they own 80% of the world's pet food market. So having new players come into the system with an alternative that's nutritionally better than what they're getting right now in terms of pet food, and also on a cost basis will work out to be the same price as what you're spending right now on pet food, I think that would be game changing.
Mm-hmm. I understand it's a huge market. I think everybody understands it's an enormous market because people are getting more pets, and as we become more developed globally and they're caring more about the grade of food and the quality of food that they feed their pets. And so it's all scaling up. And so it makes sense that it's going to be a huge, you know, multi-billion dollar industry, and it already is. But I guess my question is, that's fine. And so it presents a lot of market opportunity for new entrants, right? Because even if those 4 large conglomerates own, did you say it was an 80% share of the marketplace?
Yeah.
That there's still that 20 is rich then for profit and for new entrants potentially that have something novel to offer. However, where does cultured fit into that, I suppose? Like, I guess I'm just curious to know where the excitement lies there, because is it about providing clean protein that is based off animal sources on an ethical basis?
Yep.
And bringing down the cost? And then is that what we should be excited about most? You know what I mean? So
yeah,
I guess
that's definitely what excites me about it, about what they're doing. It's a great way. Like, I know I have a lot of vegan friends who are very conflicted when they have to feed their cats meat.
Yeah.
And so it becomes a big problem when you think about where does that meat come from? And like you were saying, you're making these choices where you're giving your pets higher quality food, but not everyone can afford to do that. And then what happens, right? You're sort of, you have your own ethics and you're trying to block that when it comes to your essentially family members, your pets.
Yeah, right. So I think, I mean, obviously as a, having not eaten meat myself for over 25 years now, it is a huge internal moral ethical conflict for me to have carnivorous domestic pets. Unlike dogs, yeah, that can be omnivores, and even they say some people are saying, I mean, there's, I haven't dug into it, but I know that they can essentially be vegetarian and quite healthy almost,
yep,
as well. But cats, as far as all the research that I have done over the years, they would not be able to be healthy on a pure vegetarian,
plant-based,
or even like an omnivorous diet. So I guess, yeah, like that's where I see the enormous opportunity for me in terms of this, as long as they can get the cost down and they can assure me that it's just as nutritionally sound and hazard free as feeding them, you know, products that have been on the market for decades that have been tested, and especially with the human grade, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, it's a huge, I guess it's a lot to think about and it's exciting, and there are still, you know, challenges, but I'd be more than happy to give it a shot.
Yeah, I think there are many people in the same boat as you, and I think people are waiting for these kinds of products to come on the market for them to be able to try it.
Yeah, I'm super excited about it because I know it's not just going to be mice. It's, you know, once it becomes cost effective, it can be a huge opportunity for us. How incredible. And it's cleaner, definitely, than producing animals that are pumped full of antibiotics and whatnot. So yeah. I mean, it's very, very exciting, I think.
Going back into the specifics of what you're working on now with the mouse cells.
Mm-hmm.
So I know you said that you chose mouse cells because they were the ancestral diet for cats, but nutritionally, how does that compare to commercial pet food that's currently available?
Yeah, no, great question. So we are still in the process of growing our tissue in batch quantities and in all of the exact conditions we will use when we produce commercially. We are still in the processes of establishing those. And those conditions that the meat is grown in, those conditions will also direct basically the nutritional quality of the meat itself. So we're still in the process of creating that. And at that point, then we will be able to do a full nutritional analysis. Of course, our priority is, you know, we're obsessed with animals, so we wouldn't ever put a product on the market unless we were sure that it's, at the minimum, it meets the threshold as, you know, as is required for sale of commercial pet food. But for us, yeah, definitely our objective is to exceed the thresholds, and so to make a more nutritious food, and of course safer as well.
Yeah,
without, you know, potential contamination by bacteria or certainly pentobarbital. So yeah, that is pending, that nutritional analysis, but it's part of the work that we're doing now.
Great, and that brings up another question that I had on my list for you anyway, which is about regulation. Like, how does it work for pet food? Is it any different than human food?
It is different. So for pet food, so there's this sort of pseudo governing body. Legally, they aren't able to enforce anything. It's called AFCO, or the Association of American Feed Control Officials. And this group, so basically AFCO is comprised of veterinarians, of folks who are in the industry already. They are the ones who basically put together a lot of the guidelines around what ingredients can go in pet food. And the FDA is ultimately responsible for pet food, but their priority is still human. So the FDA doesn't necessarily put forth any information or guidelines in regards to the regulations around pet food, but instead they rely on AFCO to do this for them. And so if a recall is made, it's made by the FDA, not AFCO, but AFCO is the one to sort of set a lot of the definitions around, again, what can and cannot go into pet food. So, for example, for a pet food company that wants to produce a new ingredient or wants to see a new ingredient included in a pet food, there are a few ways that they can go about just achieving this. One would be go through the AFCO route. Eventually, you would have approval from AFCO to use this ingredient in food, or you could go to the FDA and you could submit a GRAS application. I'd say those are the two most obvious ways that people will achieve approval for an ingredient in food.
Yeah, and which one are you going to do now for the mouse cells? Have you decided, or are you going to wait?
For our mouse tissue, we are still in communication with our legal advisor around this. Most likely, we'll submit a GRAS application.
Got it. That's great intel for entrepreneurs as well. So thank you for sharing that.
Yeah. My pleasure.
In terms of the final product, I know it's still a ways out because you said spring of 2021. So it's about 18 months out or so. How do you think the finished product will look? Do you have an idea right now? Will it be a wet food or dry food, canned? How will it look?
So that will be for our cookie, our cat cookie. It will look like just a sort of a hard treat that you would normally, you know, that you can buy from stores right now. Oh. So I have a little sample packet, but if I show you, your listeners aren't going to be able to see it. But basically, it's going to look like a cat treat, a hard cat treat that you'd buy from the pet food store, any other sort of hard cat treat. That's what the cat treat will look like. For the food, for the nutritionally complete cat food, we're still exploring. I think with our product, we'll have the opportunity. I mean, we will have the option of creating either a wet food or a kibble-based food. Most people do still feed their pets kibble. Yeah. So although that is starting to change, more people are gravitating towards fresh foods or canned foods and wet foods. The vast majority of people do still feed kibble. And so we have no intention of being a niche company. So for us, it really is important to make sure that we have a product that the majority of people are going to be interested in buying. So likely we would start with a kibble type of food or form rather, but we certainly are looking at a wet food too.
I'm just guessing that making a dry food is probably a bit easier in terms of packaging, transportation, storage and stuff like that compared
you're right to yes food. You're right, it is just having a dry food, there's of course perishability goes way down, right? So yeah. As soon as something is wet, as soon as a moist environment is involved, then you have the opportunity for pathogens to grow. Once, if you have, you know, kibble, the reason why, among a couple, but the main reason why kibble is so shelf stable is because there's very little water in there, and bacteria need water to grow. Yeah. So without having bacteria and fungus and yeast, and so yeah, in the absence of the water, you don't get pathogen growth.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. Something we were talking about earlier is about how factory farming really subsidizes the cost of meat in so many different ways. Can you talk a bit about the cost factor when it comes to your product and what you're coming up with? What plans you have for being competitive with commercial brands, and essentially what will make your brand defend its stand, if you will, against what's out there?
You know, I mentioned we don't want to be a niche product, which means we are not, our price point needs to be one that is accessible by the majority of people. Yeah. So if we're only able to achieve scalability at an amount that's still too expensive for people, then our product it won't be viable. So part of what we're doing, you know, as we build out as we're optimizing all of our science, we are constantly looking at how we bring the cost down so that we can actually bring this to scale, so that when we come to market, we will be on par with other pet foods. You know, for pet parents, they probably will observe that there's already a huge gradient in the pet food, in pet food at the moment. But interestingly, you know, as more and more people are, especially millennials, they're not having kids or two-legged kids. Instead, they're adopting four-legged kids. Okay. And so increasingly people are demanding, safer, higher quality food for their pets. So it might not be so much of a surprise to learn that actually the sale of those low cost foods, pet foods, are actually flat and declining even. And so it really is the foods that are human grade, which we are. There's only a handful of companies, human grade, organic. Again, so all of the ingredients in our supplement are certified or organic, with the exception of our seaweed, which is hand harvested from the Atlantic. They follow organic harvesting practices. The company that we work with just hasn't had the seaweed certified organic, but actually that's changing. So in the near future, we'll have that certification. Our cookie that we're launching shortly, the dog cookie, is certified organic. So more and more people are demanding that they have human grade organic ingredients for their pets, and that they know that where these ingredients come from. And so we buy all of our ingredients from within North America. We include some turmeric in our supplement. That turmeric does come from India. It grows very well there. It doesn't grow so well here. And our coconut flour we get from the Philippines. Again, an issue of just, you know, where these things are, where they grow the best in terms of climate. But yeah, we're very mindful of are the ingredients that we source, and people are increasingly, they want to know where those ingredients come from.
Yeah.
So we are priced at the moment, and we will continue to be priced even with our future product. We are priced at, I'd say, you know, a premium food, but again, by and large, that's what people want to be feeding their pets. That's what people are gravitating towards. And for people who are really, really environmentally minded, we also have just made a zero plastic commitment. So wow. none of our products contain or are packaged in any plastic. So we actually use a plant-based packaging that is backyard compostable. So that's wow. for our supplement, that's for our dog cookie that's coming out, and we will continue to be plastic free for the entirety of our company's existence. Although, you know, we're talking about animal welfare from, you know, eating animal perspective, plastic is a huge problem for all of us, for all animals. Mm-hmm.
Now, when you're launching your cultured product, which markets are you essentially looking to launch in, and are you also looking to go global with that product?
Yeah, we are. So we are, our focus is definitely on the US market. Within the US market, our focus is really West Coast at launch for the cultured meat product. So we sell from our own site. We work with Amazon. So we ship throughout the entire US. But at the moment, we are retailing in select retail outlets, but primarily in the West, on the West Coast. And that's likely where we will stay. But again, online, we are available. We do ship throughout the nation. We do certainly have aspirations to move outside of the US, so at some point Canada, but really, I mean, the market is just so much bigger in the US. And so again, because, you know, we are a mission-based company, we do want to target the markets where, you know, the most consumption happens of these meat-based or animal-based pet food products. And we're working with Amazon, actually next month even, we're actually going to be available for, through Amazon, our supplement will be available for purchase from 5 EU countries. And so we anticipate that relationship will continue to exist for our dog cookie as well as our cultured products as well. But because, you know, regulations around cultured meat are different for each country, there are some unknowns there.
No, and just speaking with you as well, I'm realizing that, you know, your product is going to be out in the market probably faster than any of the products that are being created for human consumption at this point. And so that's great, because then, you know, you will be essentially opening up the market to what's to come in the future.
Yeah, there are several startups in the cultured meat space, so it's hard to say who those first movers will be, but we're pretty optimistic that early 2021 will be in good stead to launch our first product.
In terms of the commercialization, so I know we talked a bit about this before, but I'd like to dig in a little bit more to that. What are some of the challenges in taking something from a petri dish scale to commercial scale? Can you talk a bit about some of the things that you've been experiencing?
Yeah, it's I'd say, you know, the scalability is probably, well, it is the biggest challenge for any cultured meat company. Yeah, full stop. So every single startup is working in terms of sort of their own intellectual property that they're developing. The majority of it will be around their processes that involve scaling. So I can't say too much about it, but it is hard. it's a biggie. We're directing a lot of attention and resources to this very issue, because yeah, without being able to scale, cultured meat will never come to market. So
Completely switching gears, I know one of the things that my co-host will want me to ask you is, what is it like to be a woman in this field? Given that it is such a small field right now, but most of the people that we spoke with during season one were men, and we took it on ourselves to come up with more women-founded companies to feature on the podcast going forward.
Great.
You know, we're starting that process now, but can you talk a bit to that?
I've not spent a lot of time thinking about how tough it's been because I'm a woman necessarily, but I can say that on more than one occasion, when my co-founder and I have gone into a room, my co-founder, who's a male, and we clearly introduce ourselves as I'm the CEO, and questions are directed to him, and then he'll redirect them to me. But the default is, and not because I don't think any of these folks are, I don't think any of them necessarily would intend to, and not everybody, but it does happen from time to time. The questions go to him and then he redirects them to me. And the statistics will tell you that women tend to raise less money, even though, interestingly, startups, statistically speaking, are more likely to succeed with a female in the C-suite. So it's true that very, very few female VCs that I've spoken with, but there are more and more, if, you know, coming onto the scene. And maybe I've just been fortunate. I've spoken with some people who have not necessarily. I have heard a somebody gave me a comment before, what you need to do is, I mean, it was, you know, it was, he was sort of mansplaining to me. but when this happens, then I just disengage and I don't work with these people anymore. There are lots and lots of brilliant, phenomenal people to work with. So you just have to find the right ones and you have to quickly cut your losses with the ones that aren't working. If you have a vision, you just, yeah, keep going.
Yes. Now I know that our listeners will want to learn more about Because Animals and all the work that you're doing and what you're coming out with and when. Mm-hmm. Where would you suggest they go to keep up to date and learn more about the company?
Yeah, they can check out our website at becauseanimals.com. And we do have a newsletter that we send out so folks can sign up to our newsletter and they can be alerted to any of the exciting news and announcements that we have on Facebook too, you know, just
perfect
social media.
I will include a link to your website on the little show description so that way they'll have that to be able to get to it as well.
Great. Thank you.
That was amazing. I learned so much and I am very excited for what you're coming out with.
Oh,
I think all pet parents who listen to the show will be so, so excited.
Great. Yeah. No, I'm very excited too. Well, I really appreciate you taking the time and having me and my company on the show. So thank you.
Talking about all of this exciting momentum in the cultured protein space, there's actually a focused event coming up in San Francisco, the Cultured Meat Symposium.
Yeah, and we will be there in person. So if anyone listening is also going to be there, come find us.
Yes, come find us and please say hi or tell us about the next greatest interviewee that we can be connected with for the podcast. The Cultured Meat Symposium, or CMS19, is the largest conference dedicated to cell-cultured meat technology. This year, CMS 19 is taking place in San Francisco on November 14th and 15th. And you can go and learn more and register for the conference at www.cms19.com. And if you use the coupon code AFTERANIMALS, you will get a 20% discount on your ticket.
That's amazing. Go get your 20% discount and come see us in person.
Yes, please. Then the coupon code once again is AFTERANIMALS, straight through, capital letters. That's the coupon code. Okay, see you guys next episode.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of After Animals. If you liked what you heard, please subscribe to the podcast and leave a rating and review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Or tell one friend about our show. The more people we have listening, the faster we can spread the word. Thank you. The After Animals podcast's mission is to activate a kinder, more compassionate world through innovation.
After Animals is hosted by me, Yulara Nakagawa,
and me, Sharanya Krishnaprasad,
for the animals.